This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Blue Cliff Record, case 97. The Diamond Cutter Scripture's Scornful Revilement. The pointer. If you take up one and let two go, you are not yet an adept. Even to understand three corners when one is raised still goes against the fundamental essence. Even if you get heaven and earth to change instantly, without rejoinder from the four quarters, thunder rolling, lightning flying, clouds moving and rain rushing, overturning lakes and toppling cliffs like a pitcher pouring, like a bowl emptying, you've still not raised up a half. Is there anyone who can turn the polar star, who can shift the axis of the earth? To test, I cite this to see. The main case. The Diamond Cutter Scripture says, if one is scornfully reviled by others, this person has done wicked acts in previous ages, which should bring them down into evil ways. But because of the scorn and vilification by others in the present age, the wicked action of former ages is thereby extinguished. The poem. The clear jewel is in my palm. Whoever has accomplishment will be rewarded with it. When neither foreigner nor native comes, it has utterly no abilities. Since it has no abilities, the evil one loses the way. Gautama, Gautama, do you know me or not? Suedo also said, completely exposed. I've been filled a lot with these, particularly these past couple of weeks, with a lot of what's going on, as I'm sure all of you are, what's going on in our country. And so I've been thinking about that, just reflecting on it and thinking of it in terms of karma. And so I thought I would give this talk as a way of trying to find a way in. This is a difficult koan. And, you know, in a way, to talk about easy or difficult koans is a little misleading, but there are ways in which that's also true. And, you know, in a way, it's one thing to give a talk directly that is sort of speaking directly to the points of the teaching, which is, in a sense, my first responsibility, to then relate those directly to the phenomenal world, samsara, today, this time, is more challenging, just as it is to do that in our lives, in our own individual practices. It's one thing to sit on the cushion. It's another thing to manifest that in everything we do. And so I might just be jockeying here for a handicap. But it's not only a difficult koan, in a way it's difficult to give a talk on this koan, particularly in trying to connect it directly to today. You know, in koan study, a student, I was mentioning that to somebody this week, in the beginning of koan practice, the practice is not to stand back and reflect. It's just to be directly going into the heart of each of these teachings that the student is engaging in their practice and trying to realize, and not to then step back, because the conceptual mind is still very strong and is trying to objectify, is trying to conceptualize and turn it into something solid and fixed. And so the student is urged to continually just, you know, just try and not get engaged in that, but just really keep going into the heart of the Dharmakaya. But as training continues, it becomes important when sitting with the koan to be going directly into it, but in one's life to be reflecting, to be making those connections between these fundamental, not just teachings, but realizations, which is really what the koan is always going towards, the fundamental. But then in later training, the student's job is then to be making that intimate connection with everything else, which is really up to the student. The koan isn't doing that for the student. The koan is, regardless of it, almost of its presentation or how it appears, is going beyond the world of concerns to free ourselves to see that fundamental nature, so that then as we emerge into the world of our concerns, we know how we have a basis, a ground of being from which to live our lives. This koan is an interesting example of drawing from a sutra. So the diamond cutter scripture is the Vajracchedika, the diamond sutra, that is part of the Prajnaparamita body of literature, which is one of the most profound body of teachings, I think, I would say, from a completely biased perspective, of all religious literature. Not a completely biased perspective. Not completely biased. So Prajnaparamita, sitting to the right of the Buddha, is the embodiment of the Diamond Sutra. And so here, Zuedo, the compiler of this collection, drew this passage from the Diamond Sutra, which is something that every student of Mahayana Buddhism should have studied or be studying, and presents it as a koan, which is excellent. And so I want to just read a passage, the preceding lines, just to put into a little bit of context. So the Buddha here is speaking to Subhuti, one of his disciples, and says, Subhuti, wherever this sutra is explained or spoken of, that place shall be honored. Whether in the realm of devas or humans or asuras, that place shall be honored with prostrations and circumambulations. That place shall be like a stupa. Subhuti, the noble son or daughter who grasps, memorizes, recites, and masters such a sutra as this and contemplates it thoroughly and explains it in detail to others will suffer their contempt, their utter contempt. And how could this be? Why? Subhuti, the bad karma created by those beings in their past lives should result in an unfortunate rebirth. But now, by suffering such contempt, they put an end to the bad karma of their past lives and attain the enlightenment of Buddhas. I realized before I came out here that really this could be several talks, but it's not going to be. So the Buddha, in a number of sutras, particularly within the Prajnaparamita, makes the point that when we encounter the real truth, if we don't turn away in fear and run away, then we may be ready to encounter it. So what he's saying is that we will be frightened if we're paying attention. It will shake us if we really understand what we're encountering. And he's speaking about that in terms of encountering the Dharma. If we really understand its implications, that it will frighten us because we understand, we have some sense of the implications of this journey. But we could also look at that in terms of facing anything as real truth. In other words, facing anything without putting lots of walls and barriers and buffers between us and that truth. And isn't that often what we encounter? And we encounter that fear as pain, as grief, as being overwhelmed, as anger. Something is being shaken. And the Buddha acknowledges that. And so here he's pointing to what happens to truth tellers, right? They are often attacked, held in contempt, vilified, shooting the messenger. It's like in some of Shakespeare's plays where the jester was able to say all kinds of shit to the king. Nobody else could get away with that, right? And they can do that only because they're jesters. So they're in a way, they're not taken seriously, and so they can speak the truth. That's what happens when we set about to shift deep streams, deep currents. And what's important about this is, in engaging this, all of this, is that it is non-coercive. In bringing about change, isn't this what Jan was talking about in the pointer? Even if you get heaven and earth to change in a moment, thunder rolls, lightning flies, clouds move, rain rushes, lakes turn over, cliffs crumble, you still have not raised up a half. Is there anyone who can turn the polar star, who can shift the axis of the earth? It's very beautiful and compelling. What he's really talking about, is there anyone who can revolutionize their mind? Upturn all of the deep-seated, deeply held to beliefs, views, desires that we hold so dear, and liberate ourselves. And that journey has to be voluntary. You don't always know you're voluntary. See, that's the thing. We certainly don't know what we're getting into when we begin. I think that's probably best for everybody. Otherwise, we might just have an empty hall. It's sort of like being born. We don't know what we're getting into. We find out as we go. It's not coercive. It's not aggressive. True change can't happen that way. Can't happen by force, although sometimes meeting those deeply embedded forces that would resist change have to be met with force. Peacefully, but with great effort. As we go into the path of the ceaseless, to realize that true peace is the ceasing of all creation, we have to bring forth effort to realize effortlessness. Yan Wu in the commentary says, the general idea of the scripture talks about the efficacy of the sutra itself. Someone like this in former times created hellish deeds. But because of the strength of the power of the sutra, which they are studying, memorizing, reciting, expounding, because of the power of that, they're not creating suffering. But then because of the scorn and vilification by people in this age, the wicked actions of their former ages is extinguished. This scripture, therefore, can extinguish the wicked deeds of innumerable eons, changing the grave to become light, changing the light to become inconsequential, and furthermore bringing the attainment of enlightenment, the fruit of Buddhahood. And then he talks about how in some schools, the turning of the sutra. So in some monasteries, the sutras are put together in these accordion-like forms in which you turn the sutras. And that represents that you've read, you've embodied, you've recited the sutra. And he says, but what connection is this to the sutra itself? Some say the sutra itself has spiritual power. If this is true, then take a volume and lay it in an uncluttered place and see if it has an effect. Right? What he's saying is it doesn't have power unto itself. Fayan said, realizing Buddhahood is called upholding the sutra. That's how we bring forth, that's how we revere, honor the sutra. As the Buddha says, that place in which the sutra is taught will be honored, with prostrations and circumambulations. That place will be like a stupa, like a body of the Buddha. And so it's making it very clear that our practice is not just to take the sutra and put it in a sacred place or treat it as a sacred thing, although that is important. Why? Because it changes our relationship to it. Then we perceive it not just as a book or as words printed on a page, but as something that has power when it mingles intimately with our mind. And what this koan is pointing to is the understanding of karma in Buddhism, is that from within the understanding of many, many successive lives, that in our past lives, we have been all kinds of people and all kinds of beings. And on our path of awakening, because Buddhism understands every human being's journey to be moving towards ultimate peace, ultimate happiness, through which we spend a lot of time in samsara when we try and satisfy ourselves with a lot of very ephemeral and superficial forms of peace and happiness, that on that path, we make a lot of mistakes because we're figuring it out. And we become subject to a lot of different forces internally and externally that lead us to make a lot of bad decisions. And so we create what he calls wicked acts that create negative karma, right? Karma is action based in desire through our thoughts, our words, and our actions. And those actions have consequence. And those consequences can happen, those results can happen right in this moment. They can happen in the next lifetime or in many lifetimes in the future. This is what is referred to as the three times of karma. If you don't understand or believe in karma, then you could think of it as just some results of actions will be experienced in this moment, some later, and some never, not in this lifetime. But the karma itself is immutable. So every action has consequence, whether we recognize that or not. And so the teaching is that we can only address the results of our past harmful actions when the fruit of those actions, when the consequences of those actions bear fruit, which happens in the present moment. And so here's a person who has done some unwise things in the past, but now they have encountered the sutra, they're practicing, they're turning their life around, they're dedicated to a life of liberation, of wisdom, of serving others, but they're experiencing scorn and contempt, they're experiencing all kinds of difficulties, adversity in this present moment. So that's understood as the result of these past actions. And I've talked many occasions about the difficulty of that in terms of how that can seem to make each of us responsible for things that are happening to us when they're a result of injustices, of abuse of relationships, of other things that are not really our, they are a responsibility now because we're in the middle of it. But it's not necessarily a result of something that we have done. And so, you know, this is where this understanding of karma can be a way of perpetuating, continuing social injustices and just saying, well, you know, if you're in a difficult position, that's a result of your past actions, rather than this is a larger social illness. And so when the fruit of those past actions result arises in this moment, that's the moment of our opportunity to, as Yuan Wu said in the poem, in the pointer, to turn the polar star, to shift the axis of the earth, to turn that karma in a new direction towards liberation, or to let it expire, no longer have force and energy. And that's why each moment, particularly when we're in the midst of something that's deep and old and challenging, practicing it is most important, because if we're not mindful and aware, we can very easily just strengthen and perpetuate those past actions and create new ones, which means we're just going to have to keep dealing with this over and over again in ways that are not helpful. And so those are pivot moments in which the axis shifts if we practice them. And so I've been thinking about that in terms of these recent shootings, these ongoing shootings, and then everything before, during, and after, and listening to the dialogues, the discourses. What is the cause? Is it video games? Is it mental health? Is it white supremacy? Is it racism? Is it our president? Is it our unrepaired history of violence and racism and oppression? Is it our very present history of violence, racism, and oppression? And so to look at, you know, karma is taught and traditionally is always understood in terms of one's own actions. But clearly our actions are the result of many, many actions, of all the influences we've had in our lives, the forces that we are in the midst of all the time, that we grew up in. And then so this body that has thoughts, words, and actions that creates karma, and that is trying to shift the streams of those, of that karma, right, towards liberation and awakening, we can think of larger bodies, the body of a sangha, the body of a Buddhist tradition, the body of a community, the body of a nation, the body of a government. And it's really the same thing acting out on different levels. There are thoughts, collective thoughts. There are collective words and actions. And there's a kind of collective karma. And of course, there are also, all along the way, very positive, beneficial, wholesome, in use Buddhist language, thoughts, words, and actions, individually and collectively. Otherwise, we would have blown ourselves up a long time ago. And so we need to recognize those too. That at the same moment that we're in the midst of a mandate of reckoning, I think of it, a kind of reckoning imperative, right? The fruit of past karma, of past lives, indeed, going back hundreds of years, thousands of years. It didn't just begin on this shore. I mean, we've been killing each other and pitting ourselves against each other probably since the beginning. And even in terms of, you know, our history of racism and violence against people of color, as one writer said that, you know, everything that white people have been doing to people of color, to African Americans, they've been doing to white people for hundreds of years before that, if we go back into our ancestry. All of this is karma, right? And what we're experiencing today, as it's understood in Buddhism, is the fruit, which is not always a sweet taste, of those actions. And so in these moments, just as in our individual lives, we are in a pivot moment. How we meet the consequences of these actions is not determining, because karma is not deterministic. This action does not cause its resulting consequence, but it is profoundly influential in what happens. And that's a very important distinction. Because if it was deterministic, then there's not much we can do to shift that axis. It's all been worked out in advance. And the Buddha rejected that. But he said it's also deluded to think that actions don't have results. And so if we want to change the pattern, what is practice? How do we change the pattern within our own practice? We examine. We have to hear the teachings. We have to encounter some truth. We have to examine, reflect, gain understanding, and then begin to uproot the cause, pull it up by the roots, to see what is the basis of the cause. Because otherwise we just continually deal with symptoms, which is part of the work, right? Because they're immediately accessible, or more immediately accessible. But we have to actually get to the basis of the cause, the view within the cause, the perception within the cause, which is really the mind of the cause. The Buddha said, I declare, students of the way, that actions willed, intentioned, performed, and accumulated will not become extinct, will not resolve, as long as their results have not been experienced, be it in this life, in the next life, or in subsequent lives. And as long as these results of actions intended, performed, and accumulated have not been experienced, there will be no making an end to suffering. It's not going to happen. What will happen is the perpetuation of that suffering. And so for the karmic effects, the results of past actions to be exhausted or worked through, shifted, the effects must arise and be experienced. So we can also look at this time as our time. This is our time. And even though these effects have been arising for hundreds of years, every time they arise, just like old patterns arise within us that have arisen again and again and again, as practitioners, every time they arise within a new body and mind, within a new time and place, within a new set of conditions that hopefully, if we've been practicing, are much more favorable or more conducive to that shift. And these actions that arise have been born out of our karmic afflictions, out of states of mind, whether it's on the personal, so-called personal level, or whether it's on the national stage. Greed, anger, delusion, pride, jealousy are on vivid display. And when we respond to them without mindfulness, without understanding, without reflection, when we respond to greed with greed, when we respond to anger with anger, they get stronger. They accumulate. If any of us don't know that, we're not paying attention. And they generate new actions. They lead us to generate new actions based in greed, anger, confusion, jealousy, pride, which just strengthen those currents. And because a current can sound like an abstract thing, what they're strengthening is your consciousness or the consciousness of a nation, the mind of a nation. And just as we can become accustomed to, numb to, the acting out, right? The mental afflictions and the actions and consequences of our leaders, we can get numb to those just the way we can get numb to them within ourselves, right? It's exhausting, which sometimes is the point, because then we just revert. And the idea that people in high positions are just fanning the flames of things that are already there, well, of course that's true. But it's also not true in the sense that when... It's not true in a kind of black and white way, in the same way that the only way anger can arise in me is if the seeds of anger are already present. Right? It doesn't just appear. And so when I get angry or something seems to cause, bring out that anger in me, so that person or that situation seems to be fanning the flames of my anger. It's just bringing out what's already there. Yeah, that's true. But the way in which that becomes too narrow and a kind of excuse is that when it comes out again, now it's become stronger. When it was a seed within me, the seed was there, but it's not active, which means it's not actively creating harm. So when it's encouraged, stimulated, and it comes out, now it's active, and it's actively creating harm. And that's the same, but it's different. And so it's false and dangerous to say, well, this, what we're seeing, is just what's always been there. It is, but it's much, much more. And the more we see it, the greater it, and the stronger it gets, just like it does within us. And so that's why it's so important to practice it in the moments when it arises. An old master said, if you inoculate, he's talking about practicing it in the moment when it arises. He says, if you inoculate with smallpox so that you allow it to develop in a weakened state, so to immunize yourself against an illness, you take some of that illness. And in that way, you keep it from recurring in a more life-threatening form. Suffering, contempt is like this too. Suffering is like this too. And another way of saying that is if we don't attend to today, what is today, then when it's in this form, has this energy, has this strength, then it's just going to get stronger and harder to deal with. And so how do we meet the results of our actions? That's why practice is so important for practitioners, because it's showing us this, it's teaching us about the mind of all sentient beings, about how things work. And as we develop skillfulness in meeting ourselves, we're developing skillfulness in meeting others, but unfortunately, it's not directly transferable, right? In the same way that when you work with a koan, it doesn't tell you, your insight into the koan doesn't say, okay, now when you go to the office, now when you're engaged in our climate emergency, now when you're trying to affect some change, this is what you do. It doesn't do that. That's our personal and collective work. An old master said, karma is a residual force of actions. Whether actions are good or bad, they depend mainly on the mind. Mainly, recognizing that there are, every action is taking place within an environment and a history. Thus, the presence of exceptionally strong wisdom or resolution can cause karma to change. And what he's telling us here is it's not going to be easy, right? We are told that up front. We tend not to hear it because we think, yeah. You know, I've done difficult things in the past, right? I've got this. I'll figure it out. Maybe it wasn't easy from you, but it's going to be easy for me. I'm just that kind of person, right? No, he's saying the presence of exceptionally strong wisdom or resolution can cause karma to change. Karma means what is possible, not what is predetermined. Hence, it can shift. It can shift. In a certain sense, it is shifting all the time. The question is how? In what direction? For whose benefit? The Buddha says, if one says that whatever way a person performs a karmic action, in that very same way they will experience the result, in that case there will be no possibility for peaceful life. and no opportunity will appear for making an end to suffering. What he's talking about, this deterministic view, that if my action is already has within it the result, then there, and that's our belief, or if that were true, then there's no possibility of actually liberating ourselves. He says that, but if one says that a person who performs a karmic action that leads to a result that is variably experienceable and will reap its result accordingly, in that case, there will be a possibility for peacefulness and an opportunity will appear for making an end to suffering, to alleviating suffering. And so this koan says, because of the scorn and vilification by others in the present age, because of the present adversity, because of the present difficult results of past karma, if we engage it that are variably experienceable, right? So different people are experiencing what's happening in every moment in different ways. And that doesn't mean that everything is relative in a fundamental sense. What works for you doesn't work for me. That's just the way it is. Buddhism has never taught that. That there are fundamental truths based in human nature and human experience. But recognizing that we will experience things differently because of our karma. And if we reap its result accordingly, if we bring about a consequence, if we meet that karmic fruit accordingly, there is a possibility to shift the axis of those karmic streams. What does it mean, accordingly? According to what? Well, we say according to the Dharma, but that just really means according to what is true, according to what is worthy of your trust, according to what is worthy of taking refuge in, according to what works. See, the thing is, samsara doesn't actually work. That's why it's so tiring and exhausting. Because it takes so much energy to prop it up and keep it in motion. Because it's a hungry ghost. Its purpose is not fulfillment. Its purpose is to keep going. That's its function. It's not to ever bring you to any fulfillment. Its purpose is to just keep the engine going. Practicing according to what is true, its purpose is fulfillment. It's cessation of that spinning existence. I should have been more than one talk. Oops. So when we meet, when the way we meet an action, the way we meet greed is within greed, anger within anger, pride within pride, we know. We know how it's going to continue. We don't know the particulars. We're not in the prediction business. But we know that those karmic, that mind will continue, will be perpetuated. And the results of such a mind will continue. And so we have to take our example from the world. How does water meet water? It meets water as water. Earth meets the earth as earth. Air meets air, the sky as air and sky. But water meeting water is not the same as anger meeting anger. That's just more anger. Hatred meeting hatred is just more hatred. When the nature of water meets water, when the nature the original face of anger meets anger. It shifts. That's what the Buddha is saying in the Diamond Sutra. Because of the scorn and vilification by others in this present age, the karma of those past actions shifts and moves towards liberation. And so the whole of the koan rests in this, because of the scorn. What does he mean? Well, what we know, and what we should know as practitioners, is the more distance you put between yourself and anything and everything, the greater the suffering, the greater the delusion, the greater the obscurations, the more work will have to go into propping that up, giving it a semblance of working. The closer we move, the more intimate we become, the more that illusion of separation disappears. The fruit of those actions is extinguished because we realize it's not something. It's not something. It's not a thing outside. It's not a thing apart. It's not a thing at all. It's the power of mind to create realms that we see, we perceive, we believe in, we move in and inhabit. And so the Buddha said, due to karmic causes and the conditions in your body and mind and all around you, each moment appears to you. Each moment appears to me. It is not you. It does not belong to you. You cannot possess it. It is only to be experienced. That's it. It is only to be experienced without attachment, without clinging. And so to meet the burning house of today, the struggles of our time, the racism, the nationalism, the xenophobia, the fear that exists before the inflaming of that fear, the anxiety of existence, the anxiety that's within all of our attachments. Why else would we grasp so fervently but for fear? So as practitioners, to face that fear, that hatred within ourselves, which is the result of past actions, and to shift the axis. And in doing so, to begin to have some sense of how do we meet that in others, right? Which means we have to work with the anger, the fear within ourselves towards others, towards the other. And I think in a sense to do that, we have to really acknowledge our grief. The grief of our own existence and suffering, of our collective pain, of our world, of our planet. Because if we really don't acknowledge that grief, I don't know that we're going to get very far. I feel like in so much of the discourses and talking, it's the thing we're talking around. Because you know what? If we acknowledge that grief, we'll realize everyone's there. Everyone is there. And that grief is just energy. It's a force. But if it stays grief, it's not useful. It has to shift. It has to transform into something that is transformative. It has to gain wisdom. Because otherwise you just become self-absorbed. And it's no longer even about the thing that we're grieving about. It just becomes sort of self-fulfilling in a not very fulfilling way. And so how to hold that grief becomes a very important part of our training. You know, we can think that, you know, I'm going to do this and I'm just going to get far, far away from that stuff, you know. I'm going to be enlightened to an island where I'm free of grief. I see you guys are still grieving, but hey, you know what? I'm cool. Remember the story of Avalokiteshvara and how her head exploded? Grief. And then what happened? She put herself back together again and took another step. She had a vow that she was committed to. That vow is us. And so to meet that grief, but not to abide there. And in a sense, in that moment of abiding, when we see ourselves abiding, we can ask ourselves, as the Buddha, in a sense, would ask us in that moment, what are we seeing that we see as permanent in this moment, but is impermanent? What are we seeing that is solid and fixed and impenetrable and intractable and distant, that is actually selfless and immediate? What are we seeing that is untrustworthy, that we're trying to turn into a refuge? In the poem, Yanwu says, or Suedo says, Gautama, Gautama, do you know me or not? Why are we asking Gautama? Ask that one sitting on your cushion. Do you know me or not? What is this sutra, this body of the Buddha? How do we awaken and meet this self and the self of a country, of a people, of a mandate of reckoning? It's time. It is our time. So I'll end with a poem. As many tears as ocean drops. A broken heart is a sign of life. Having life, treat it with meticulous care. Do not take it away. Rather, let the pain fulfill its original path like boiling steam that vanishes into the deep, blue, endless sky. Now, having encountered the basic lightness, let's together enter the scars of the burning. You know, just as that master said, you know, we will be challenged. You know, my basic experience is that the world kicks my butt every day. Pretty much. Right? Knocks me down. And I find myself in a moment of grief, in a moment of outrage, in a moment of, have we not yet actually begun the conversation? But I cannot dwell there. I do not dwell there. Not for too long. Because there are the scars of the burning that are calling. And the thing that we may be surprised of over and over is that in that you find joy. There is where we encounter joy and peace. But we have to go together. That's the thing.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.